world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, from no policy at all toward Africa, from a United States position of deepening drift toward isolationism, and of course in the aftermath of the debacle in Angola, the very strong statements issuing forth from Washington in the person of Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, especially warning and threatening the Soviet Union and the Cubans with any further adventurism abroad. Some very strange statements are now pouring forth from Washington and from leadership in government, especially with regard to a new policy toward Africa. From no policy whatsoever following the Angolan debacle, United States foreign policy now seems to have two totally contradictory approaches or points of view. One is to vigorously endorse majority rule in southern Africa, however, vigorously endorse majority rule only in those two countries which are still basically white democratic countries, and not to whatsoever vigorously endorse majority rule in any other part of Africa. The policy is to vigorously endorse majority rule in southern Africa, not in Namibia or Angola or Ghana or Nigeria, not in Chad or Niger, Mali, Kenya, Burundi, Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda, or Zaire, but in Rhodesia and South Africa. Now, secondly, they hope that as a result of doing this, they can prevent further Angolas by seeming to threaten United States retaliation if Russians or Cubans become involved in military operations in Rhodesia or Namibia. Now, as you listen to some of the statements made recently by Dr. Kissinger during his African jaunt, it's a little hard to understand. First, most Americans seem to be completely ignorant of what is really happening in Africa. Most do not realize that almost all African states are minority governments, and that almost all of those in the Afro part of the Afro-Asian bloc of nations, who unfailingly, by the way, shoot down U.S.-sponsored U.N. initiatives, who almost always vote contrary to the United States, who condemn Zionism, a form of racism, and who themselves practice racism on a grandiose scale and discrimination on a gigantic scale, that almost all of those African states are minority governments of a black elite. Nothing is said of this, basically, by the federal government. Apparently, as long as the regime which is doing the discrimination is black, then all is well. Now, of course, people could make many claims against the United States of America. They could say, rightly so, that we are not a perfect or an ideal democracy. And they would be correct. They could say we do not have true racial equality, and they would be correct. They could say there is still unjust discrimination in the United States, and they would be correct. They could say there is racism, and that sometimes that racism is sponsored and fostered by governmental, political, and religious bodies, and they would be correct. They could say the same thing about South Africa. But they could also say the same thing about any other black African country with a black African elite in which you find some of the bloodiest and the most brutal forms of tribalism, racism, of the group instinct, of the divisiveness that results from a black elite of a complete dictatorial autocratic government in the hands of the military, which plummets the hopes of a despairing people as they leap madly from the arms of one dictatorship or one foreign colonial empire into the hands of a far worse taskmaster, which has been the agonizing history of Africa in the post-World War II era. Now it seems we want everything tidied up in Africa. We want to know that practically every country in the entirety of Africa leaps into the hands of a military black dictatorship. And it seems that our government, leaping from the idea of virtually no policy whatsoever toward Africa, swallowing the bitter pill of Cuban and Russian intervention in Angola must now go the full swing of the pendulum to the opposite extreme and decide we cannot feel very happy here in the United States, have everything all tidied up, until we see the disappearance of all democracy in whatever form, however imperfect, however unidealistic, from the entirety of the continent of Africa. It doesn't make sense to me. I can't understand it. The hollow sound of Uhuru screamed by the voices of the millions in Africa has yet to be satisfied, because those who threw off the yoke of foreign empires, colonial empires, have invited instead military dictatorships who little by little are now gradually, subtly being drawn into the orbit of the biggest colonial empire the world has ever known. So that as the Portuguese, the British, other independent regimes of white minority groups such as Ian Smith's in Rhodesia, and of course the government of South Africa, and they are not together, by the way, they're two separate countries. Many Americans don't seem to realize there are vast differences between those two countries, but there is no such thing as apartheid, for example, in Rhodesia. They insist on thinking that it is a simple stereotype black-white problem down there, which it just is not. But nevertheless, the point is that government after government in Africa is a dictatorship. And that as they have thrown off the yoke of the various colonial powers of the British, the Portuguese, of the Belgians, the Dutch, and others, they have leapt into the arms of black military dictatorships. And now, little by little, it seems they are drifting into the all-embracing arms of the communist octopus that is trying to swallow up the entirety of the world. Why a Secretary of State of the United States would be in the business of warning foreign governments that they had better do thus and such, that they have very little time before they do thus and such, and why he is dictating those terms to various Southern African governments, I cannot imagine. He would not dare do so to any black minority government. Now, would you like to bet on that? I mean, I can sit here and point out to you that of the 49 countries in Africa, 15 of them are under direct military rule, and 29 of them have one-party civilian governments kept in power by the military. How about that? Only 5 governments in the entirety of Africa, and that excludes even Egypt and Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco, up on the northern shores from which we buy a lot of our oil. That excludes countries such as Egypt, which is a minority, a one-party system, the educated elite in the hands of one man whom I have met and interviewed, who talked about the end of his term, but of course smilingly talked about what he was going to do as the next term began, because there's only one way to vote. There's only one party running for office, and it has only one candidate. If you vote, that's who you vote for. This is democracy. Sure, this is what we want in all the rest of Africa, apparently. But I can sit here and tell you that out of all of those governments, only 5 of them have multi-party political systems, and out of those 5, 2 of them happen to be Rhodesia and South Africa. So it is hard to understand. From open threats to intervene militarily in Cuba, which I heard Mr. Kissinger say in person down in Dallas not so long ago, and which I knew was just so much smoke in the air because it's impossible. Now we're going to threats toward the South African white regimes that they had better change, that they had better give up the multi-party system and leap into the arms of a black military dictatorship. And then you would see a mass exodus of the whites who have developed the country, whose expertise and know-how has brought Rhodesia and Southern Africa to a position of standard of living paralleling closely those of Northwestern Europe and of the West. And you would see instead a massive migration of peoples who would have a horrible time settling, but probably they would choose Australia in favor of either the United States or Britain, if I know those people very well, and I think I do. But you would see tens of thousands of them either driven out or through fear simply leaving when they have been there generation after generation after generation. And then eventually, you would see a black minority rule replace a white minority rule, and that black elite would then probably be overthrown from time to time by violent revolutions as one dictator fought another. And finally, as the country became more and more impoverished, you would see it, too, gradually drawn just through attrition, through the destruction of modern industrialized techniques, through the impoverishment of its people, and through the constant drain on its resources, through the maintenance of a large standing army to wage war internally and against its neighbors, you would see it drawn into a communist orbit. I've heard some hypocritical statements in my time, such as that made by the oil minister of one of the North African blocs, that it was absolutely inadmissible, speaking about the United States, in a meeting of the OPEC oil ministers in Geneva, that it was absolutely inadmissible to think of any great power using its natural resources as a political weapon. His point, that oil minister, was that the United States should not make statements about possibly thinking of cutting off food grain shipments to some of the OPEC oil producers in retaliation for oil embargoes. And yet, this character who made that statement was one of those who voted together with the OPEC blocs to use a natural resource, fossil fuels, which makes the world go around, as a political weapon against the United States following the Yom Kippur War. But here's another one of those examples of a little bit of hypocrisy that just about takes the cake. This from Mozambique. Now, it just so happens that Mozambique is another of the very recent countries in Africa to have thrown off what people would look upon as the yoke of a colonial empire. And in this case, of course, like Angola, it was Portuguese. So Mozambique gained its independence. Its president is a leftist of the Marxist stamp. His name is Samora Machel. He said, and I quote, "We would like Dr. Kissinger and the American government to worry first about getting rid of the illegal Smith regime. They must not ask about the Cubans and the Russians. They must not try to divert attention from what is happening in Rhodesia. This is a case of an illegal, minority, racist regime. And the choice is between supporting those who oppress and those who want freedom." That came out of the mouth of a man who is in charge of a Marxist state which harbors the guerrillas who are butchering and shooting black and white alike across the border in Rhodesia, a Marxist state that has confiscated all private property and has confined thousands upon thousands of its citizens to concentration camps. And the man who made that statement calls the Ian Smith government a minority racist regime and talks about our choice in the United States is between supporting those who oppress, meaning Smith, and those who want freedom, meaning Machel, who is a leftist Marxist in Mozambique, who has appropriated all private property and has confined thousands of its citizens to re-education, a polite word for concentration camps. Now, you've heard some examples of blatant hypocrisy in your time, but that one's a blue ribbon. That one takes the cake. That ranks right up there with the oil minister of one of the North African states. You know, as you listen to some of these statements made by Dr. Kissinger on this trip, it makes you wonder, are there any remote political overtones here at home? Is peace going to be the result of all of this? This new American policy toward Africa of condemning two out of the remaining five democratic institutions in that entire great, huge continent. Is peace going to be the result of Dr. Kissinger's pledge of unrelenting opposition to the Rhodesian regime? Is the United States going to urge democratic revolution in South Africa and see a completely idealistic democratic system arise out of the ashes of the destruction of a white minority regime? If people only knew the truth about what is really prevailing in Rhodesia and South Africa, if they only knew, for example, that there was a massive migration of blacks that came into the area long after some of those early colonists and pioneers got into that area and began developing the country, if they only knew that the black Africans in the nation of Rhodesia have an average income that is considerably above twice as high as that of all of the residents of the rest of every one of those African nations. But they don't tell you that. They don't tell you that the per capita annual income of the average black in Rhodesian is more than double that of his black counterpart in every other country in Africa, with the single exception of South Africa, another white regime. They don't tell you that more than 50% of the students in the university in the capital of Salisbury of Rhodesia are black. They don't tell you, for a matter of fact, that as Rhodesia has striven mightily to make leaps and bounds in educating its black masses, which it has done, and the story has never been told in the United States, that it has progressed in a tremendous way, and that while Rhodesia has been developing, more and more Africans have been drawn from their traditional tribal barter economy in the veldt and the fields and the jungles into the modern industrialized centers, and as a result, the total earnings of African employees during a period from 58 to 75 quadrupled, while European employees a little more than tripled. So proportionately, the Africans were even growing in their earning capacity at a faster rate than the whites. And even so, by choice, most all of the black Africans still live in a rural, traditional, subsistence setting, in a barter economy, as tribal individuals on their various tribal homelands. I've been there, and I talked to Ian Smith, and I've talked to leaders in government. I've interviewed them. I came back and showed our television and let our radio audiences hear the truth about what really is happening in Rhodesia. I saw the area of one farmer with a vast area of corn that I've got to relate to you because it is indicative of exactly what does prevail as you see some of the blacks in the completely traditional tribal areas who live like sharecroppers, but in practical fact are squatters, undisturbed, allowed to be there on thousands upon thousands of acres of farmland all up and down one of the very rich farming areas of southern Africa. Here was a fourth, fifth generation Rhodesian farmer. His father and his grandfather before him had farmed that land. He was using modern methods with which I personally do not agree because it had to do with chemical and all of that type of fertilization. It was not natural in the sense of using organic, that's a very unpopular word sometimes, but nevertheless, it was chemical fertilizer and all that. But he was out here and he was using all the traditional methods of big farming techniques of monoculture that are employed in Iowa, Illinois, and the like here in the United States. So consequently, with huge gang plows and motorized equipment and farming hundreds upon hundreds of acres of corn, he would plow and he would harrow and he would plant and he would fertilize and he would irrigate. And so here were these vast acres of great, tall, healthy-looking corn waving in the gentle breeze. And right next to his huge, big farm were these blacks who lived on the property and who lived in their traditional tribal customs. They were, of course, eking out a living with a little corn patch on their property. Now, the black African neighbor came over one day, very irritated, and he said that there must be some demons, some superstitions, or some voodoo magic or something. There was something wrong here because the white farmer had better crops. And he accused the white farmer of having the best land, while he, just across the fence, was on the poorest land. The white farmer said, well, we can do something about that. I will help you with your crop. And so he did. And he went over, and instead of a little tiny patch about 30 by 60 feet that was grubbed out with a hand wooden plow and a hoe of some kind, by hand with the women doing the work, the white farmer went over there with motorized and mechanized equipment, and he broke up that hard band soil and got down underneath it, and he liberally sprinkled on the fertilizer. He prepared the soil, he planted the seed, he watered it and irrigated it, and up came corn that looked just exactly like that across the fence. And so instant prosperity that autumn. And the black African farmer found himself with an awful lot more corn than he could use. Suddenly, relatives began to arrive. He found himself moved from the position of a farmer with a group of ramshackle huts in which he and his, I guess, 4, 5, or 11, whatever he had, wives, were quite content, with all their many children about, with a lot of native fowl and guineas and chickens and some pigs and a cow or two, whatever it was he had. All of a sudden, that place became a virtual village because all these wives had brothers and cousins and uncles and sisters. And all of them had married relatives, and they had married relatives. And so when they learned of the newfound prosperity of this farmer, they all came pouring in there, and suddenly on the adjacent property near this thorn brush area out here on the edge of this farmer's vast corn farm, a virtual population explosion ensued because there was all that free food. So this farmer found himself playing host to all these people. Well, problems began to arise, and discontent, and sometimes some arguments, and once in a while a fight, and sometimes some injury. And this black farmer decided he couldn't put up with that. And so next year, he refused any help from the white farmer. And he and his wives went out there and grubbed up a little tiny part of that acreage, and they sowed them some corn all by hand, about the same size they had done year after year after year before, maybe a quarter acre or less. And that's what they were content with. Now, gradually, as the food supply diminished, those other people who'd come moving in there found out that they had to go live someplace else where the living was a little bit better. And so, gradually, they all moved away. Now, this is a story that is really true. It merely is intended to illustrate the point. The Rhodesian government has done a great deal which is practically never told in the United States in its attempts to upgrade and to educate and to lift people out of a virtual, savage existence and to try to bridge the gap of a lost 50 years in education by bringing those people up in education and making them in the 20th century with knowledge and skills and with understanding, with education, so that they can continue to improve themselves. And let's take a look at the way it really is instead of listening to the stereotype the way it seems a lot of the media would like to have the average American believe, because it just is not that way. We need to understand that Americans remain in almost complete ignorance on the subject of majority rule in nation after nation in Africa. That of the 49 countries in Africa, 15 of them are under direct military dictatorships, and not one of those 15 countries have come in for any censure. Not one harsh or strong word has been spoken by the American government toward a one of them. Why? If we're going to condemn minority governments, which I think I would not want to enter into a discussion as to whether that is the right, the privilege, the duty, or the calling of the United States government, but nevertheless, if that's what the government is going to do, then why not condemn all racist governments, all elite governments, all minority governments? And when you see a minority rule by a black elite, which is viciously and bloodily oppressing other blacks, which happens in Africa every day in dozens of countries, then let's condemn that too. It's the only fair and the only honest way. You see, I happen to believe that if the elite minority in Rhodesia were black and were not white, the United States would be talking about giving them assistance instead of threatening them with sanctions. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that, but I also think that Britain would be doing the same thing. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised by what the sudden attempt by the government to forge out some type of a policy toward Africa may result in practically forcing and pushing those white minority regimes into the hands of the communists by forcing them to sell their products, if not directly to the Soviet Union, then most certainly to the communist Chinese. I think that you're going to find that the plan of the government in trying to formulate a policy toward Africa, because of the fact that it is so completely lopsided and does not recognize that if it is going to condemn minority rules, it ought to condemn all minority rules, and is not doing so, that it's going to find that that policy backfires. But I can't help but wonder, and of course it's just a speculation of mine, that perhaps some of these statements made abroad, especially in the attempt to stereotype
what is happening in Africa as a simple black-white problem. And when you look at what is happening in the United States, principally the idea, the issue of busing, of forced integration now, of private schools, an issue upon which former California Governor Reagan and a presidential candidate has now spoken out upon, and what has been happening in Boston with racial violence here and there in American schools, I can't help but think that the overtones of all this are going to result in very sharply redefined racist lines in the United States of America, and that's the part that really worries me. It's very, very sad indeed, because peace is not going to come from that kind of statement. The United States of America is not going to have peace either in far-off Africa, if that's what we are trying to obtain, nor are we going to have peace here at home by the kind of statements that have been issuing forth from government these days. All the way from open threats to intervene militarily in Cuba, when every American knows we would never do such a thing, to open threats to do something, whatever, but at least giving aid and comfort to those who deliberately seek to bring about the downfall of one of the five remaining democracies in the entirety of Africa, including the man who is a Marxist, who has taken away all of the private property of individuals in the nation of Mozambique, who has consigned thousands of its citizens to concentration camps, and who then turns around and makes the incredible statement that the United States government must choose between supporting those who oppress, meaning Ian Smith, and those who want freedom, meaning that Marxist government in Mozambique with its thousands living behind barbed wire. Well, I would at least like to do my part to try to help inform people about what the truth really is. Once again, I am not saying, do not let anyone misinterpret what I say about the Ian Smith regime. I happen to know that there is discrimination. I know that it is far from perfect. I also know that it isn't all white or all black, all good or all bad, that it's a mixture of many of those elements. I do know, too, that most Americans are utterly ignorant of what is really happening in Africa and have not gotten the real story about what life is like in Rhodesia. When you walk the streets in Rhodesia, you don't see signs that say white only. They're non-existent. When I went down there, I took a black man along as a member of our television crew, and he found himself able to travel more freely and openly in Rhodesia than in many of the states in the South in the United States of America. I know, because I sat down and ate meal after meal with him in the leading hotels. So if people, because of ignorance and because of racist tensions and racism, want to just make some great big blatant false assumption and leap to some giant erroneous conclusion and try to idealize or in some way to stereotype the situation down there by making it black and white, they are making a grave error indeed. Well, if you want to know what the loss of Angola really means to the West and what all of this turmoil in Africa is leading toward, you need your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine. The latest issue has the article on Angola falling to the Reds, what it means to the West, the Plain Truth. Free of charge and no price, if you dial right now the toll-free number, 800-423-4444, get your name on that magazine and you'll see a follow-up in my Speaks.com column on this very issue of which I've spoken today, virtually everything I've told you. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.